So Roberto has basically told you what the equation or how the equations of motion look like in this formulation, and also he's discussed a little bit of how to put or impose initial boundary data, or initial data, which in our case is boundary data. So that would be the same picture you have to face as a first step in a 3+1 formulation. You want to first choose the equations you want to solve, then you have to choose the initial data you want to evolve with your equations, and finally the most important one, at least for numerical purposes, is the coordinate or gauge conditions you'll be using. Just as in the 3+1 splitting of the equations, we also have four basic gauge variables to give. One array we have chosen by asking this R coordinate to be locked, basically area locked. So that means that for R equal constant, U equal constant, the area of these two surfaces always have an area of 4 pi R squared. So we need to give three.
Is this only in spherical symmetry then?
No, in general. In general. That's a determinant. I mean, this condition ends up being a determinant on the HAB, the intrinsic geometry. And that's why instead of having three variables, we have two encoded in HAB. The R is just a constraint. So we need to give three other coordinates, three other conditions. In order to give some connection with the 3+1 approach, if you, say, try to examine the intrinsic geometry of R equal constant surfaces, then the metric induced on that three surfaces can be written this way. And so this is the very familiar picture that you have in the 3+1 case. You can recognize that UA is playing the role, the same kind of role that the shift vector is playing the 3+1 decomposition, and that e to the 2 beta b over r plays the role of the Laplace square. So we have to give these two conditions. The important thing is that, well, in this case, you just given them at some word tube, and then from there on, you have to iterate these hypersurface equations that Roberto was showing a while ago, basically tell you what this the value of these functions should be as you go out to scry. So we do have to give them freely at some R equal constant, say, and from there on we just have to solve the equation so in order to obtain them. So contrary to the 3+1 case, we're not asked that free to give anything we want. Given something on some word tube, then they are determined by an evolution, by a hypersurface iteration. So far in all our tests, we've either obtained these functions by analytic solutions, say in Trashel it's very simple to obtain and this is zero or some constant, or and then beta is zero in that case. Or you can induce them by white hole geometries as we'll talk on Thursday. But that's basically the pictures. So we also have to face that the same problem that the 3+1 formulation faces, but in our case, we're much more constrained. As Roberto said, the main problem of this formulation is that it has caustics, and whenever caustics and crossover happens, your coordinate system breaks down, and then it becomes useless. That, I would say, is the only reason for not to use this formulation, because in any other respect, it far outperforms the 3+1 case. But this is a very severe limitation of the method. One difference, if you think of the Kruskal diagram and you're using this U coordinate adapted, say, to the inner horizon, you know that the time an observer at infinity will measure will go to infinity as you approach the horizon. So you have to distinguish where an infinity of an observer at sky is either due to your approach to the horizon or just because you're having caustics and so you're having a similarity in your coordinate system. But luckily, it's pretty easy in most cases to differentiate whether you've covered the whole space-time basically outside the horizon or that you are encountering a caustic. Both will manifest as a divergence of the outgoing rays going to zero. But in the case where you're hitting a caustic or a crossover, that usually happens in a local regime. So at some angles, you see the beta going to minus infinity, the beta variable going to minus infinity, while if you're hitting the horizon, basically everything is going to hell. And also, you can also use, if you're calculating the radiation, you know that the radiation as you approach the horizon is redshifted away. So you can also use that as a measure of where you're getting close to the horizon or you're just hitting the caustic. Let me just mention briefly about what it is known in the analytic realm for this problem. As opposite to the 3+1 case, where what many studies are found in the literature, in this case you actually don't find that much. I mean, basically the main studies in this area were done by Murray Sumhain and Seifert, Helmuth and Alan Rendell. The main problems you face when you try to prove anything about the solutions of this system is that there is a very different structure of the domain of dependence for any given point. Let's think for a moment what happened in the 3+1 slicing. Suppose you are interested in the solution here and you're given data at some initial hypersurface. So the domain of dependence of this point is naturally finite. While if you're trying to do the same thing in the characteristic case, you're given data on a characteristic surface, unless you have a time-like or a null boundary that makes that region finite, you'll have an infinite domain of dependence. And so you have to deal with the problem of boundaries, while in this case you can prove local theorems without even considering what is going on at the boundaries. So what is known about this system is that for the time-like null case, that the wave equation is well posed. You also see that if you're given some data here that is many times differentiable, the solution that you get at this point is roughly just half as many. You can take half as many derivatives, and they're going to be smooth. So you lose half an order of differentiation. In the case of linear SGR, it's very simple to just use some theorems that are in the literature to prove existence and uniqueness, but you cannot prove well postness. In the case of full GR, well, since Einstein's equations are quasi-linear, you can use standard theorems to extend this result into full GR. In order to prove well posed, as I said, there are outstanding issues that have to be addressed, like how do you give consistent boundary data? Because whatever you give in here as your initial data, which is free of constraints, you can actually give whatever you want at the initial data, will propagate and eventually hit the boundary, so you're not free to give anything you want here. A very rigorous study is still open in this in this area. Good signs about where one could actually try to prove well postness of this problem is, as I talked with Helmuth in the past, that there is a possible extension of the periodic Nagy theorem that he'll probably mention tomorrow, where you can actually prove in the 3+1 case that for a specific formulation you can give initial data and you can give boundary data that is consistent so that this problem is well posed. So there is probably an extension of this to the characteristic case. And also, as we'll talk on Thursday, numerical implementations are really robust. We've tried to actually break the evolution of the code many times and we haven't been able to do it. Diverting a little bit, since we've talked about singularity excision, and well, you think where you can use the characteristic formulation to do a singularity excision. Of course, you know you cannot use outgoing characteristic surfaces because the black hole horizon is a particular outgoing characteristic surface, but you could use incoming characteristic surfaces and try to find there the marginally trapped surface or the trapped surface to excise the singularity that is inside the apparent horizon. In that case, so you have to give boundary data on some outer boundary and then iterate the equations radially in. If you assume that you're not looking for the marginally trapped surface, but just say you're looking for a spherically trapped surface, then the problem becomes algebraic. You basically have to monitor one of the components of your metric, and whenever it changes signs, you know you're already inside the apparent horizon. If you want to look for actually the marginally trapped surface, then it's an elliptic problem, but the good news is that it's just a 2D problem, so it's much simpler to implement. And this thing that we've been hearing in these first 2 days about causal difference is much, much simpler to implement. It's much simpler to implement a scheme that whatever you're doing on the inside doesn't affect the outside, and we'll mention something about that on Thursday. Basically, finally, you also want to calculate physically meaningful quantities. The one we're most interested in is the radiation. So as Roberto said, one of the nice features of the of this characteristic method is that you can compactify and integrate all the way to infinity, and there you can read off basically the radiation from your metric variables. So you just compactify using a conformal factor in the usual way. The Nusz function is a pretty simple equation, although in their actual implementation is quite nasty, but it can be done. Then you have the balance equation, so you know that the rate of energy output from, carried by these gravitational waves is related in this way to the max, to the mass of the space-time, which basically, if you were in a bounded frame, in order to obtain the news, you just have to pick up the 1 over r expansion of that metric HAB, and just the time derivative of that is basically defining the news. In general, you have to deal with the bonding Metzner Sachs group at Scry, but you can actually do a transformation to go to a bonded frame. That transformation involves an elliptic equation, and that's the only elliptic equation that we have to deal in this problem. And then you can propagate that bonded frame along the null generators of Scry to obtain something that is physically meaningful. The mass, in order to obtain the mass of the system, that's also doable, but it's more tricky because you don't have to pick the 1 over r term of one of the variables, but you have to pick the 1 over r square. So it's more difficult to implement numerically. And then there are several proposals for angular momentum out there. They all basically make sense, but it's also very complicated to obtain numerically. But in principle, one has access to those quantities. Just to summarize, let me mention the main difference with any 3 plus 1 formulation. First of all, we have fewer variables. Let's say, comparing to the ADM formulation, where you have 12 variables, we only have 6 in this case. And compared to some well-posed hyperbolic systems that are being proposed, we have much, much fewer variables. The gauge freedom, we don't have that much. As I said, we are constrained by what we choose at some word tube, and then from there on, we have to solve the equations to obtain them. The true degrees of freedom are handy. They're basically just readable from one of the from some of the metric components. The initial data can be given unconstrained. That's because we're given data on a characteristic surface, and on a characteristic surface, the metric need not be a continuous thing. As I said, you need the time-like ordinal boundary in order to make sense of just the domain of dependence. The causal properties of the space-time are strongly exploited in this formulation. It's very clearly adapted for wave description because, well, you're just slicing your space-time with respect to characteristic surfaces. You can compactify the space-time and include the whole space-time on a finite grid. This is not a difference with the conformal method, and that we'll hear from Peter Huebner's talk, which is the only R method out there that can give the whole space-time for you. The constraints are straightforward to implement in the double null case. Those are the constraints that you metric variables have to satisfy on the time-like or null boundary. And, of course, the main drawback is whenever you have a caustic or a crossover, that kills your evolution. Unless, well, there are two proposals out there. The most interesting one was given by Friedrich and Stewart, which is basically integrate through the caustics. Or you could try to use several coordinate patches to just, whenever one of the coordinate system is going wrong, you change to another coordinate system. But both of these proposals are going to be very difficult to implement, though. So I don't think we'll ever. Okay, then Stuart. And Stuart made that suggestion. Okay, that's basically.
Well, let's see, I'm sort of a little bit confused because, I mean, interested as I should, but people used to say, because of these causes, you never want to use just a no formulation, but because it has such nice properties, what you want to do is to do some Cauchy formulation inside, the no formulation outside, and mash them together to get a characteristic formulation. What progress has been made on that? What stage is that now?
Well, we'll talk about that on Thursday. But yeah, that is still true. In the very nice world, that's what we would like to be doing: having a 3+1 formulation in the interior, having a characteristic formulation in the exterior, and maybe even having a characteristic formulation in the interior next to the singularities to help in this causal difference in treatment of this just excising the apparent horizon. Because as we'll see on Thursday, it's much simpler to implement in the characteristic formulation. There is ongoing work on trying to get this characteristic, Cauchy characteristic matching to work. The main result there is that, in a way, matching the numerical implementation of the matching was ill-conceived right from the start. And we'll hear something about it from Bela's talk tomorrow, I think. Because the matching module, as it is written at the moment, reads the characteristic information, if you want, and then injects that into the Cauchy part of the domain, but it's injecting everything. And as he'll talk, that's wrong. You cannot give all the variables. There are some, you can give something freely, and the other things have to be obtained by an appropriate and a smart use of the constraint. You can imagine that if you have a boundary, you'll have modes propagating this way, modes propagating the other way, and then modes propagating parallel to the boundary. So the characteristic revolution need not know anything about these modes propagating parallel. And so that might introduce some kinks that eventually will drive the 3+1 evolution unstable. So there are issues there that have to be worked out, but this paper, this work by Winnicore, Gomez, and Szilagyi, basically have shown a way to probably go around that and actually try to understand what you can actually give us, inject from the characteristic part to make the whole thing stable. So this part of the talk was basically just introduce and explain the whole formalism, and then we'll take off from there on Thursday about numerical implementations of this.
So what were, if you're doing for two black hole collision or some other, that sort, I mean, what are the two null surfaces that you're going to choose?
No, I wouldn't even dream of using just a characteristic formulation to solve the black hole case. What I could try to do is if you have, say, one singularity here and another singularity there, is try to use this sort of thing, the Cauchy here, the characteristic here, but maybe we can cut the holes here and use some incoming just around the singularities, and just maybe for a very small area.
Those up and down lines are time-like or no?
These ones?
Yeah.
These are time-like. You can actually use the characteristic code by itself in a post-merger phase. Once these holes have merged, then you could in principle just use this one. It's just a single characteristic formulation because you can adapt, say, this is going to be a null surface, so you can adapt a double null problem to that. If this is a horizon that corresponds, I have to do it the other way around. Suppose this is the horizon of the merger. I could try to use an incoming formulation to integrate all the way up to.
Where is the data being posed?
Here. I'm going to be posting the data here.
And where else?
Oh, we'll talk about that on Thursday. I'm going to be putting. I'm going to end up doing an inverse scattering problem. That we'll discuss on Thursday, but you could do that. You could say, okay, suppose you give data here, that's what you want. That's precisely what you want. But you could just now come out with this inverse scattering problem where you say, okay, suppose you start giving here and you give zero. Okay, then you run your code backwards and you obtain something here. Now you could say, suppose if I were in a regime where I'm perturbing the Schwarzschild black hole, then you could use the time-symmetric property of the Schwarzschild space-time and induce from the data that you obtain here, correct what you did there, and do all the and you reiterate and obtain. That would be the physics of the white hole, but no, because then you can flip the picture. I mean, well, we'll talk for an hour probably on Thursday over this. Right, no. No, we always assume that we're in an asymptotically flat space-time and we have a smooth sky. If we don't have that one, then I guess we'll run into our problems. But we've been working under that assumption.
By the way, what is known about initial value formulation with a partly space-like hypersurface and then partly no? I mean, there's Cauchy characteristic matching kind of situation. I mean, has anyone But I mean, what has different type of initial data that one is specifying on the null surface compared with the space-like, and presumably there's some matching conditions with the boundaries.
Yes, there is someone who is very acquainted with the French man who has worked in Africa, called Cagnac, and worked on a whole school of students working on characters.
Are they working the characteristic value problem for GR or in GR?
The coordinate problem.
Oh.
For linearized GR, you look inside L, work this out in a linearized case for collapse to a form of black hole, the curving of a Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse, somewhere in the setting where you have Cauchy slices inside and all slices outside. That may be of some useful guidance.
In the end, one thing that's going to be problematic if you do the next problem for the Einstein equation is knowing what to do with the constraints on the space-like time. Because sometimes you have matching conditions between the characteristic values and the space-like time. And you need to be able to produce solutions of the constraints on the space-like time which are consistent with matching. I don't, this may be related to what you were saying in the talk, but somehow how to get the
two things to be consistent, right?
So you take some space-like region and you solve some constraint, and then there's some boundary. And then now I want to choose null cone emanating from that boundary. Right? Now the statement is that there is some restricted class of solution which will have to do something on this boundary.
So if you are just doing wave equations with no constraint, then you have the consistency condition between the Cauchy data and the characteristic.
Right, but there is that phi agrees here, and the scalar field agrees.
Okay, this